new friends. I was hesitating to give a talk here because I figured everything that I had to say everybody here knew very, very well, which is certainly true. But there are some new things afoot in the business, and particularly having to do with an experiment, a reactor experiment to measure theta-1-3. And as we speak, there is a meeting starting in Alabama, which is fairly well attended. I'll pass this around so you can see what kind of talks are going on at this meeting. And I think there will be several collaborations being formed, and I'll tell you about the physics of what that's about a little later on. And meanwhile, because some people like Gary have been bugging me about Camland, I'll include Camland in this quick review of low energy neutrino physics. And so picture of the sun that Bob Svoboda made from the Super K data, there's no physics in that, but it's a nice thing that you could actually survey in the location of the Super K detector if you didn't know where it was. Actually, we didn't know where it was early on. It turns out the surveyors had surveyed in the tunnel to magnetic north instead of true north. Okay, so this is the picture of the neutrino landscape. I think this is Hitoshi Murayama's fancy plot. And the various indications of oscillations are some funny business. Tan squared theta, and sometimes you see sine squared 2 theta, so you have to watch out whether it's log or lin axis, and the usual delta m squared. And this is a confusing plot because it has both new E oscillations and new mu oscillations, possible oscillations on it. And there are the super K oscillations at this level at around 2 times 10 to the minus 3, and the famous plots of the atmospheric neutrinos measured in super K, giving this tremendously large effect up to down in terms of zenith angle, and evidence which seems to be inescapably new mu to new tau with almost full mixing. The LSND data leaving some disputed small band up here at smaller delta m squared, but going down to smaller mixing angles, now being checked by Mini Boone, and we'll all have to wait patiently for a couple of years. And especially since they're not getting their promised luminosity, I have no idea how long it'll be before that. We'll get some information from them. And then the various limits from accelerators not seeing anything in new mu to new E, and the solar neutrino experiments, which we'll talk more about, giving the solution in this range of LMA, just the big picture. You remember there was the small mixing angle, MSW, which is everybody's favorite MSW that should have been there, but too bad. The low, this triangular region where there's day-night effect, and a little place here that usually escapes but is pretty well dead now. And my old-time favorite, the vacuum oscillation solutions down in there, which seem to be totally dead. And then here come the Camland measurements here, which we'll talk more about, again, nailing down this LMA region. You've seen this many times, both here and elsewhere. You can expand the unitary mixing matrix, which is nowadays the MNS or PMNS or MNSP, or with Pontecorvo getting on the front or back, depending on where you come from in the world, and break it up into the solar neutrino piece. I think Evgeny is the one who popularized writing it this way, which is a very nice way to see what's going on, the atmospheric neutrino piece here. And then this piece that mixes the other two together. And the strange thing that we see is that these mixing angles, this thing is just about as 45 degrees, so that these guys like to be maximally mixed. and that these guys here contain the CP violating phase and this famous theta 1-3 that we don't know whether it's zero or not. And that is the hottest issue in the business right now, because if that's zero, then there is no CP violation to be measured. And of course, then there are these other phases that everybody happily forgets about over here, which cannot be accessed by regular neutrino oscillations experiments, but can be gotten at through double beta decay, but are only, not everybody forgets about them, right? Majorana phases. And of course, the two possible mass hierarchies, which we know that the sum masses now from the WMAP is less than 0.7 eV, and I have to say WMAP plus, where'd Danny go? WMAP plus assumptions is less than 0.7 eV, somewhere in that range. And so that these are the two remaining possible hierarchies, and then we can argue about whether you can throw a sterile neutrino in or not. Now, this was a slide I picked up, I didn't say in the beginning, I picked up a lot of these slides from a couple of talks in particular, some of them from my own talks, but a lot from Stuart Friedman and from Carson Heger, both of LBL. And Stuart gave a talk pretty much like this at the SLAC festival, neutrino festival, a week ago, but it'll be 2 weeks ago this Friday, where SLAC is considering futures, and one of the things they're discussing is big surprise neutrinos. And there is a working group at LBNL which is discussing neutrino possibilities for that laboratory. Essentially every laboratory has some sort of a neutrino program in their future. And so these were the initiatives that they, the questions that they wrote down. How do you attack the question of Dirac or Majorana neutrino? Well, double beta decay. Absolute mass scale, direct mass measurements, or if Tom were here, Tom is gone, so we can not talk about Z bursts. And direct mass measurements, of course, are notoriously hard, and there is a program you may not know about at the University of Texas, beta decay endpoint, Manfred Fink and company, which is cranking up, and I think we'll do a pretty good job with a non-magnetic spectrometer. But it's a terribly hard business, and it doesn't look like they can get in the tritium endpoint measurements down below around 0.1 eV. And well, that, yeah, even that is enormously impressive. So the question then, first question is, how small is theta 1-3? And mostly people have been talking about accelerators, and now there's new talk about reactors, which you'll shortly hear more about. CP violation, it looks like we're stuck with accelerators. We can't do it with the cosmic rays. Mass hierarchy, the way to distinguish the mass hierarchy is through matter effects and long baseline experiments, possibly even after some long-term measurement with atmospheric neutrinos or with a, oh, damn it, what's the name of the European experiment with the magnetized layers? That's not going ahead. Monolith experiment, thanks. Or an Indian neutrino detector. I have to put in plugs for everybody's favorite detector. Verify oscillation, that the survival probability doesn't just go down, which is all that Super K has seen so far, but see that it recovers, and the real indication of oscillation, that it's not some sneaky decay that's fooling us, despite the fact that the stupid models, of which I have been partially guilty, have been largely eliminated. We still would like to see it recover. Super K will do this sooner or later, and there will be a few sigma indication of a recovery from Super K within not very great time, as soon as we get the Monte Carlo straightened out, which was screwed up after too many changes were made simultaneously. And LSND question, of course, waits upon Miniboom. If it's correct, then there will be all kinds of trouble. The solar neutrino question. What we've measured so far has mostly been out in this branch with the solar burning. Most of the burning, of course, going on and the PP reaction and being down in this small 0.1% branch with the boron 8, which is the higher energy neutrinos, which are mostly what are measured by, entirely what are measured by super K, and then chlorine coming down a little further, and the gallium getting down in sampling the PP. And here's a picture of Ray Davis looking over his tank, Ray who got to go to Stockholm last fall. And the gallium-germanium experiment, which didn't have a calibration, till Kirsten always raged if you said this was a calibration. This was a cross-check, not a calibration. But in fact, they put a very strong source and were able to cross-check the detector. And by the way, it's not that clean. You know, there's a lot of lines in the spectrum that are in there, so I think it's fair not to call it really a calibration. And an amazing piece of chemistry to sort out the germanium from this big tank of gallium. And then the super K elastic scattering measurements, which you've all heard any number of times about, where for the first time the sun is seen by the direction in real time in a counting experiment, and you know that you're looking at the sun, not some other source of neutrinos, as is always the problem with a geochemical experiment or a radiochemical experiment. And here the process is the scattering off the electrons, but there's also a contribution from the neutral currents, which amounts to about 17%, and so one gets a taste of both neutral current and the electron neutrino signals. But then along comes our friends from SNOW, having deuterium in their detector and being able to observe inverse beta decay. And they measure three processes. They measure the charge current, the neutral current, and elastic scattering. And I think you've all heard many talks about those beautiful results. Here is where the results all line up in the Bacall slide that everybody shows that's been worked and reworked with the chlorine experiment. But it's important to remind ourselves of this, that most of these experiments, the yellow is the boron, and that has mostly been what's measured, and it's only the gallium experiment that has measured the PP, and that there's no way to really satisfy this. If you shrink these guys down, the predicted compared to what was measured, if you shrink the boron, that doesn't get you there for the gallium, which is measuring about 2/3, and so you have to have some experiment has to be wrong, or there has to be something more than solar model. You can't do it by fooling with the solar model. Many people spent many years trying but didn't succeed. And this is one of the prettiest plots anywhere, I think, of the from the SNOW results with the three bands for the neutral current. This on this axis is the flux of mu and tau neutrinos, and this axis the flux of electron neutrinos. So the sum of these two is neutral current, constant value that is measured for neutral current. So you get a band from the neutral currents like this. Charge current, only measuring the electron neutrinos, gives you a vertical stripe like this. And the elastic scattering, including the super K measurement, which comes right down the middle of this, is at a slight angle. And by golly, they overlap. It looks like a textbook example of, it looks too good to be true, actually. It's a little scary. But there it is, and says that those fluxes are just about 1 to 1 to 1. Okay, so let's see. I think I've got something out of order here, but well, we'll come across things as we come across them. The first detection of the neutrino, of course, was our old friend Fred Rhinus with Clyde Cowan here back in the 50s, measuring at reactors. And there has been 50 years of these kinds of measurements. And it's this inverse beta decay measuring with nu e bars on protons, giving a positron which comes out right away, gives you, if you have a good enough detector, can give you two pulses right away, or in a big pot like most of the detectors, it gives you a blast of prompt light of a few MeV minus the threshold energy. And then the neutron left over wanders, meanders around in the liquid until it gets captured and releases the characteristic 2.2 MeV after 180 microseconds or so.
Wasn't it in 55?
And then, you know, the experiments went on over a couple of years and published. You can argue about which was the definitive, right, experiment. And the long stories about the cross section. We won't get into that. Well, they got the cross section wrong at first.
That's the famous factor two?
Yeah. Right. They got the cross section wrong. And the truth, I've always been a defender of Fred and company on this because they weren't trying to get the cross section. They were just trying to detect the neutrino that people had said wasn't detectable. And they plugged in the numbers and they did a very bad job of error analysis, essentially none. So then there had been a large series of experiments, but the CHOOSE experiment has been the most recent definitive, along with Palo Verde. And they were 1 kilometer away, and they measured such things as the rate versus reactor power. So it's good to see that that comes down nicely to zero at zero reactor power. You laugh, but that's not entirely a stupid thing, because there are some residual radioactivity, and you have to be sure that you understand all of that.
And the error bar looks small zero.
Yeah.
Why does this thing have all these spikes coming out?
Oh, that's where the phototubes are.
Oh.
And that thing sits inside of a bigger tank.
Okay,
and then this is a plot that shows the history. This was a Giorgio Gratta plot, I believe, stolen several generations. And this has baseline and power times target mass, the exposure. And then this is just the 1 over r squared lines of different detection rates. And this is 10% per year, and this is 1% per year, statistical, in other words, 10,000 events per year. And you can see that, of course, limited by power and size of the detectors, things move up along this curve. And here's Camland falling a little below the curve at a few percent per year. Yeah. That wasn't a question noise. That was Poltergeist was the original. The name of the original Rhinus-Cowan experiment.
ILL?
Institut Lau Langevin. So here's the Camland detector that is now operating and reported results last December, measuring neutrinos from reactors around Japan. It's right close to Super K in the middle of Japan, and dominated in terms of its rate from anti-electron neutrinos from a complex called Kashiwazaki. In total, all of this amounts to about 20% of the world's reactor power. And so most of the events are in this range, but it samples even out to reactors some fair distance away. The expected rate, if there were no oscillations and the reactors were all running, is about 2 events per day. What in fact we actually get to analyze with the reduced fiducial volume, which I'll show you in a minute, is more like a half an event per day. So that's what you should have in your mind for thinking of the statistics. So this is the Kashiwazaki complex, and there are 7 reactors there, many of which are shut down now, just for your information. There's been some problems with Japanese reactor housings and cracks in the housings, and they've shut. There's been a bit of a scandal, and in fact, we have a hard time to get the rate, the energy, the power level versus time out of this reactor people. They're very sensitive about releasing it. So I've been suspicious about what they're trying to hide, but I guess what they're trying to hide, I suppose, is simply that they're less efficient than their investors believe them to be. So they have been reluctant to release the information to us, but our Japanese friends have managed to get it. So 79% is within 138 to 214 kilometers, averaging at about 175 to 180. This is what, during this data, which went from a year ago up through the end of September in this first report, this was the reactor, the effective reactor power weighted according to the distance for us. And you can see there was not too much modulation here. Since then, this has gone, with these reactors shutting down, this has dropped down to around here. And so we're getting some, not reactor off, but reactor at low power data. But you can see with those nasty large error bars that it'll take a while before we'll be able to do what you would really like to do, which is track the modulation as the reactors go off and on with season. Historically, they've had a low period down by 20-25% in the spring and the fall, and they make more power in the winter and the summer for air conditioning. Those are number of events, just the total in the sample. And so this is the number expected at the CAMLAN site when you put in the calculations. I'll show you the error list in a moment. Turns out to be 87 events or so. And the systematic error from power is said to be less than 2%.
What's the energies?
The energies that we're measuring here?
Yeah, those numbers refer to what?
Around from 1.6 to 4 or 5 MeV. I'll show you the spectrum in a moment. So this is the distribution of events selected within the first 145 days of live time. This is the balloon in some funny projection. And the fiducial cut, I'm not sure whether I put the slide in that shows you why we have to do this. I remind you that the balloon has scintillator in it, and the balloon has about 1,000 tons, and then there's 2 meters of clear oil, and then the phototubes. There's a lot of radioactivity from the stainless steel structure and so on around the phototubes, and so you don't want to have scintillator there. But near the edge of the scintillator, the neutron can wander outside. And so you have to make the fiducial cut a little bit inside. And as it turns out, that's not as precise as you would like it to be. It annoys theoreticians that we don't have a better fiducial volume determination than we do. But that's life in the experimental lane. There are effects near the edges, and So for conservatism in the first round, the cut was made well inside. And here is, this is the energy for the neutrons and the delayed energy, which should be 2.2 MeV. And here is the delayed energy versus the prompt energy. And so there's some background events down in here, and here are the events that are accepted. There's one event up here which is consistent with expectations for neutron capture onto carbon. And so there are 54 events, and you can see that it's quite clean. And you can also see that if you extend this band out here, we can set a limit on anti-neutrinos from the sun, which we're working on and some other people working on, but there's unfortunately no hint of any tricks, so it'll be an upper limit. No need to get excited. The backgrounds are very small. This is the beauty of this kind of measurement, that the two hits really kills the backgrounds. There are a lot of backgrounds. I'll show you in a moment, but all the radioactive material that it's left around can contribute some background. Solar neutrinos make a background, and the cosmic rays going through make interactions with the nuclei, photonuclear reactions, and they leave some of the nuclei in excited states, and some of these excited states last for a very long time. There are some states of, let's see, of oxygen and nitrogen. There's not much oxygen in here, but some of them are tens of seconds long. These things sit there. So you have to record all the muon trajectories and fit the trajectory up, and then if you get something that looks like an event near a recent muon trajectory, you veto that event. So you have to make a changing fiducial volume, which is a little painful. The accidentals, that's to say just the random probability of a first hit with a second hit, where the two have nothing to do with each other, where the requirement is within those energy bands, within 2 meters of each other, within the fiducial volume, these various cuts, is essentially totally negligible. Fast neutrons can sneak in from the outside. If you have cosmic ray interaction outside, the neutrons can wander around. But we've got a couple of meters, and outside that couple of meters of mineral oil, there's water. So the chance that the neutron gets all the way in is quite small. The biggest background is the leftover tail of these spallation reactions, and that is a matter which can be adjusted by how severe you make those cuts. And where we chose to make it, it left about total background of one event. So the net bottom line is the number observed minus this one event background divided by the number expected is about 60%, and the statistical errors are twice the size of the systematic errors as of this point, because it's not very big statistics, and that is not one, and it's not one. We can argue, there's been some debate in the community. Mike Turner was giving a hard time. Someone gave a talk at Fermilab and said that it was a four sigma effect, and it's not. And quoting sigmas for something like this is silly anyway, because it's not a chi-squared distribution. There are long tails to various distributions. So the better thing to say is that this is, with our simulations, better than 99.95%. But if anybody is upset like by that and wants it to be only 99.9, okay, the statistics will get better. And this is what the spectrum looks like so far. And by the way, the next reduction will be done. We're having next collaboration meeting is in September, and we'll start getting out the next reduction for then. So here is energy Now, down at the bottom here,
energy of what?
Visible energy. This is the visible energy less the 1.2 MeV threshold. And so this is not neutrino energy. And down at the lower energy end, there's a background which is also interesting to some people and has never been measured before, which is the sum of neutrinos from all the radioactive processes throughout the Earth, which is mainly the uranium-thorium chain, and mainly from the rocks in the neighborhood. So to interpret it properly, you have to have some kind of geological model. And for the first reduction, we simply set a cut on the analysis at 2.6 MeV to leave out the expected geoneutrinos. And then way down at the bottom, you start to get into some accidentals as the rate goes screaming up. There's a background rate that's going like this down in low energy end. So we left these guys out of the analysis at first, but you can see that there's no great anomaly in the radioactivity of the Earth in any case. This is the expectation, the green part, and you can see that you can't add very much on there to the expected around total of 20 to 40 terawatts from the Earth. What else to say? Oh, the other thing to say is that notice that the distortion, this is expected, this is what we see, and then this is some best fit with oscillation, but you see that it's not a lot different from just scaling down the expectation. If we got the normalization wrong, there could be no oscillations at all. And what you will see in terms of the fits to oscillations is a kind of a backing into it, because it, well, I'll show you in a moment. What we're seeing are those regions which wouldn't have produced a big modulation that we didn't see. So this is the systematic uncertainties, and this is the most painful one, the fiducial mass ratio. You can easily see how to get this. If I choose a fiducial volume with a radius of 5 meters, 500 centimeters, and I have an imprecision in fitting the vertex of a track of 5 centimeters, that's 1% or 3% of the volume. So you can see that a small imprecision in the fitting of the vertex turns into a large imprecision in terms of the fiducial volume. That will get better as we better understand things. But you can see the limitation of this kind of an experiment right here, that there are various efficiencies here at uncertainties at the level of 2%. And you can squeeze on all of these a little bit, but not too much. So it's very clear we're never going to get below a couple of percent with this experiment, right? That's simply not going to happen. And the goal was to get to 5%. I think that's manageable. But 2% is beyond reach, 3%, 3%, 4%. It's a tough business when you're doing an absolute rate.
Are you talking about just the systematic?
Yeah. Yeah. For the statistics, we can just sit and wait, right? So if we're getting half an event per day, so we're getting an order of 100 events per year. If you wait 10 years, you'll get to 10,000 events. Then you get to 1% statistics. So after a few years, we'll be down close to the systematic limit. So as usual in this kind of thing, you get the juice right away, and then you have to wait painfully as you reach the plateau. Okay, so this is the history of these reactor experiments as a function of distance, the old experiments, and they measured what they expected as a function of distance, and this is what you expect with the solution to the atmospheric neutrinos, and this is with our point plotted on here. Now, of course, this this plot is a little funny because there's energy involved in this, and you can't exactly. You can imagine we had many, many arguments about how to make a fair plot that represented what's going on when
is
it's really a.
For given energy or for the average energy of your events?
Yeah, for the average energy. And then this represents the band of solutions. So don't, you know, you don't want to get too excited by this plot. It's fairly representative of what's going on, but if you look hard at it, you realize it's kind of a funny thing to plot.
Do you understand that this one early point that's, what is it, Rovac or that's way off at 1.2? But it's huge error bar. Well, that's huge error bar.
No, this guy?
The second point, yeah.
This point, but yeah, look at the size of the error bar. That was Savannah River.
Oh, that was Savannah River. And
yeah.
People know why that is?
Well, the error bar is enormous. I don't remember why, but all of these guys. In fact, I would take exactly the opposite conclusion looking at this plot, is that there's something phony about this because they're too good. There should be. With this number of points, there should be some that are outside of one sigma. The chi-square to this is way too good. This is just like these plots from LEP, where they all agreed too well.
But presumably at that time, people fit those points to some curve and deduce some angle and some delta m square.
No.
This is
well, people were always hoping to see some deviation. But in the face of no deviation, then the plot is sensible.
So what's the history?
In the face of a deviation, then it's not so sensible.
No, the later ones are looking for oscillation.
Neutrino oscillation came after Reines and Pond?
Well, Pontecorvo had made his mumblings and so on.
I didn't know there was a solo neutrino problem in the 1950s.
No, I thought Pontecorvo was mumbling very early on.
He was, but of course, you know, he was mumbling about neutrino-anti-neutrino oscillations, not neutrino flavor oscillations. Okay, so that's another small point. There was nothing to oscillate into. So this is another oscillations diagram showing where the Camlan data fits, and this is the data as reported, and the best fit point is right up against the wall at maximal mixing. This is with a cut to leave the terrestrial neutrinos out, and the red blob is the LMA from the solar neutrino experiments. And this is what I was saying, is that we reject these two regions above and below because they would have produced more spectral deviation that we didn't see. So you get better resolution in delta m squared than you have any reasonable right to have with its small statistics. And then this is when you take the flux all the way down to 1 MeV, and then the fit comes inland a little bit, but there's more loose parameters because you had to fit for the terrestrial neutrinos, and at 95% confidence level, we put it between 0 and 110 terawatts, big deal. Okay, and then this is Hitoshi Murayama plot showing how these things lie on top of each other, the various solar solutions, and what Camlan does in the exclusion. Again, we've had many statistical arguments about the question of making exclusion versus inclusion plots, and if anybody wants to get into that, we can get into it, but it's, I think, a little boring. And so Camlan pretty well clears out all of those other solutions, and when you put in the allowed regions, it looks like this. Clown plot. And so three neutrino generations, the NUI survival probability depends upon two mixing angles, and we'll get more into this in a moment. In any case, in the region best fit by the CAMLAN solution, it's mostly dominated by the Theta-1-2. And I like this plot from Bacall and Company, Krastev and Smirnov, because it really shows you why we're stuck with the LMA solution and not some of the other old favorites. The vacuum, this is energy, and node a log scale. So most of the measurements that we've been making, like super K measurements are up in this region here, just up in this region here. So that's why super K doesn't see any spectral deviation. And this is why our old friend the vacuum is dead as a doornail, because you have to see big spectral distortions. The SMA, you also had to see a big spectral distortion, and it's not there. And the low region has escaped for a long time because it's not that much different. But it's hard to get the gallium experiment, which is tasting down here in the 1 MeV range, has about two-thirds of the solar flux. And whereas these other guys have got one-third, so you've got to get this up higher and this down lower, and it is driving you to the LMA solution.
In the SMA, I think we don't see anything at all. But this is for the solar nucleus, with matter effects.
Yeah.
For CAMLAN, you don't have any matter effects.
No. Right.
You wouldn't see any effect.
Well, okay. No effect at all, right. Yes.
Yeah.
This plot, yeah, I should have said that. This plot applies to solar neutrinos exclusively. Okay, so the way I like to phrase it is that the CAMLAN is the end of maybe not the end, but the culmination, at least, a triumph of 50 years of the same reaction. We're using the same reaction that Rhinus and Cowan used way back 50 years ago, and we have finally seen a deviation from expected results without oscillations, and have seen, I would say, more than hinted at, the geoneutrinos seem to be there at the right levels. And that gives a convincing picture of oscillations with peculiarly large mixings and with masses that, as we all know, are not so far apart. Now, what's the status of these new experiments? What's going to go on with solar neutrinos in the future? Here are the experiments, the seven experiments that have been run. We won't go through this big table, but just to show you that there are a lot of experiments being discussed. And I think it remains to be seen how many of these are going to get actually funded and brought to fruition. CAMLAN, of course, is running. Borg-SINU should have been running. For those of you who don't know, there was a disaster in the Gran Sasso tunnel. Some pseudocumene and other nasty chemicals leaked out and were seen by the local activists, and the mine got shut down. And it now seems that they will only be able to run by changing their scintillator if they're going to run at all. They can't use pseudocumene. And it's a sad situation. These people have labored very hard to make this experiment, and nowadays I'm hearing from some people that it may be that it will never run, which is really sad if true.
How much leak?
I think it was 50 liters is what I heard. It was
not a lot.
But it went down the drain and into a local stream, and there were claims by people in the neighboring town that they could taste it in their water from their sink. This was not good.
What kind of chemical was it?
It's a pseudocumene.
It's
a scintillating material. It's a nasty, long organic chemical that is carcinogenic. At any rate, we'll run through some of these a little bit. So Borg-SINU looks like this, very much like CAMLAN. In fact, it's the other way around. CAMLAN pretty much swiped the design from Borg-SINU, which has been building for a long while. But the main thrust of Borg-SINU is to measure the beryllium line. And there are not reactors in Italy, so that background is out of the way for them.
The reactors in France are too far away.
Yeah, they don't count so much.
But how come the ones from Korea?
Well, they don't count for much at all in Chemland either. They're at the less than 1% level. So here is, now, what you see, of course, is not the neutrino spectrum, but you see if there's a line in the detector, what you see is an edge. You see something up to that energy. And so this is what the backgrounds look like. This was actually the predicted backgrounds in Chemland from spallation and long-lived radioactivity. And you can see what a lot of fun it is to do an experiment like this, that you have to know the background and the source of the background, and it's an absolute counting rate experiment. It's the kind of experiment that makes me shiver. And adding in the solar neutrino signals, then you see the beryllium window for us is this range between 300 or 400 keV and 800 keV, where the beryllium will hopefully dominate.
But doubling the amounts of events there.
Hmm?
Factors of two above background. Or?
Yeah. So this is no trivial measurement, and what's more, to get to there in Chemland, some of the backgrounds, the uranium-thorium backgrounds, are still too large by quite a bit in the scintillator. And so right now we're going through a process of putting in a very fancy filtering system to filter the scintillator. But some of the backgrounds have to come down by nearly 10 to the sixth, which is a lot. So the beryllium measurement is a hard business. Why should one go ahead and measure solar neutrinos? Well, you should ask John Bacall, the great advocate of this. John would like us to measure even the width of the beryllium line and so on. But certainly, if you get down there and measure the PP very well, it tests the MSW. You really want to see this fact that there's less suppression at the lower energies than at the higher energies. It measure theta-1-2 accurately and help with the interpretation in various ways of the other kinds of measurements that you want to make. It does not, however, even a 1% measurement of solar neutrino measurement, as you can see in this projection here, sine squared 2 theta del m squared, doesn't squeeze that much on measuring of the mixing angle. It's a hard row to hoe, but it's nice that it overlaps. Okay, here's one of the experiments being talked about, being pushed by some people back east, called CLEAN, using liquid neon to do a high statistics, low threshold measurement. I'm running way behind. Skip through these fairly fast. Here's one that anybody who's been around here has heard many times about in the past. Heron, the Bob Lanou at Brown, talking about using liquid helium and measuring thermal fluctuations, individual quantum fluctuations in the liquid. Pretty fantastic technology, but it's only now coming to fruition after, what, 20 years of study, something like that. X-mass, very much discussed these days, a Japanese collaboration with American collaborators. Also, there's Giorgio Grotta working up at Stanford on a xenon detector, but kind of the flip side, to do double beta decay. Think of something so big filled with liquid xenon, which has to be purified and is enormously expensive. So limitation, xenon is a wonderful liquid to use for this kind of experiment, but it's very expensive. The lens experiment, which Raju Raghavan has initiated over many years, continues, they're probably shifting their target, but they've most in last few years been talking about using ytterbium 176, which has a nice property that you get a two-step signature from it. You get the prompt electron less a 300 keV threshold, and then after a 50 nanosecond delay, you get a de-excitation with a characteristic 72 keV. So this, again, the two-part signature gives you a nice clean signal in principle, but there are all kinds of problems with having purity, having enough enhancement of the ytterbium 176, which is, I've forgotten now, 10%, I think, in the natural, 10% at natural abundance. And you can either do isotope enhancement or live with the other materials, but you have to watch out for things like 176 luthium. It's a tough business, and it's not clear whether that project is going to go ahead or not. Skipping on to the question of theta 1-3 and CP violation.
John?
Yeah.
Before you change the topic, I'm puzzled about the motivation for the low-energy neutrino experiments. let me just say what my puzzlement is, and somebody who's thought more about that could help me. One of the motivations for doing it is what you said, that is, it's some measurement of the energy spectrum of the survival probability of comparing the low-energy PV neutrinos to the high-energy neutrinos. But the high-energy survival probability is something that you don't know very well because you don't know the boron-8 flux, the boron-8 flux. And so I'm a little puzzled by the degree to which having more accurate measurements of the low-energy PP neutrinos is going to help you if the dominating uncertainty is on the theory of the high-energy ones. What am I saying that's wrong?
I think the boron-8 flux is well known on from smoke, on the neutral kind of charge population.
But I could... that tells you the survival probability.
Yeah.
That does not tell you how many sterile neutrinos there are.
That's true. If you assume no sterile,
I'm not prepared to assume that. It's under my contract with to allow for sterile neutrinos.
You could just revert your argument. You have probably at least a 20% certainty of the boron flux if you compute it from. This is very optimistic.
Right.
From absolute numbers, and changing the boron flux is not going to change the changing the boron cross section is not going to change the way the sun operates. It's not
exactly.
It's just
I think from the calculations, it's 1% supposed in the PP, 7% in the beryllium, and 20% in the boron.
This is very optimistic because 20% is the error on the cross section measured at the totally irrelevant energy. And the extrapolation.
Right, right.
So it may, in fact, be worse.
Okay. So, I mean, and it would be interesting, actually, on the graph also to have a plot of the total width of the standard solar model. I mean, not with the base, but accumulating the values of the sensor solar model. So I think for that reason, it's interesting to make the check and to see that, indeed, you get the same number for the protons. It may not teach you about what if there is a problem there, it's the only way to know about it. You are not going to be able to interpret it directly in terms of physics, and that's, I think, Boris's point is perfectly right. But, okay, if it's a confirmation, it's a confirmation. You might have two effects going in opposite directions, fine. But if it's a confirmation, we can accept it. If not, it's interesting anyway.
Okay, thank you.
Right.
Sorry.
No, that's a point well taken. Okay, so shifting on to theta 1-3 and CP violation, as everybody here knows very well, it's hard to separate theta 1-3 and the little delta. that they, in general, with the kind of measurements where you're measuring the conversion, you're stuck with some sort of degeneracy. Is this your plot, Danny?
No.
Oh no, this is from Brook. This is from the Brookhaven report. This one you claim is wrong?
Yeah.
What's wrong?
They don't account for immediately. No, Japan always assumes that everything else is
not perfectly right. Oh, okay. Any case, the point of the slide is simply to make the to argue about the or bring up the question of the degeneracies. And this is the limit that one can get to in this kind of a an appearance experiment with theta 1-3 with some sort of mixing in this range. Chu's is out here, present limits. Minos will not press down too far. JHF super K and these other proposed measurements, NUMI off axis, and Brookhaven to Homestake could press down into this range. The question is, all of those are a fair ways away. This one's going to happen in the next couple of years. These are not going to happen for half a dozen or more years. Can we do something sooner? And so if you look at this plot, and if you blow it up and put in three neutrinos and look more carefully, you'll see that there's actually some oscillations in there. How do I release this thing? I was lazy, so I... Well, does that work?
Yeah.
Sort of. Where's the focusing knob on this fellow? On the lens. Okay, so if you write out the oscillation probability for, I guess I'd be better on the far side here, write out the oscillation probability for, or the conservation of Nui bars or Nui's. This is the usual term, which is the delta m squared 3-1. So this is the atmospheric oscillation. This is the 2-1 term, and then there's a term that has both in it. Now, if we're looking at short distances, then we can take this term to be approximately 1 if this is mu e3 is small, which we know that it's at least not bigger than 0.16 or so. And if we take short distances, kilometer or so distances, and energies more than around an MeV or so, relatively near the reactor, then we can approximate this by a form which is more like this, 1 minus with this oscillating piece, which has the larger delta M squared in it, but an amplitude which is given by theta 1-3. Which we usually forget about in making these plots. And so there's a chance to measure theta 1-3. Oh, and of course, the very nice thing about this is that in this way, you can say a benefit or a liability is that the delta CP drops out. So there's no question about CP violation in this. This is, if you measure this modulation, you are measuring the theta 1-3. And jumping ahead to the game that's going to be played, if you look at the ratio of rates in two detectors, where then I will have the oscillating piece here, and if one of them is up fairly close, then this will be a constant, and the other piece will have some modulation in it. And the nice thing is that almost all the systematics cancel out. And so it's a question of how well can you survey. And, well, you can survey to a few centimeters at kilometer distances. And how well can you build two detectors that are exactly the same so that the fiducial volumes are the same? Well, you can do that surely better than to 1%. Can you get the energy scales in the two detectors to be exactly the same so that that will cancel out? And then we have to argue about engineering details. The best thing to do would be to have a given detector on tracks, or two of them, and then we switch them back and forth. Then you can probably cancel the systematics out down to the better than a 1% level. And so then you can start to do some serious measurements of theta-1-3.
To see these oscillations, you're going to have to measure the energies well?
No, not particularly well.
Oh.
If you're using the ratio.
Well, because one of these is going to be relatively flat, you said, and the other is going to have the oscillations, but it's going to be very energy dependent because you have a big
Delta M squared. Right. But you don't have to, because this is what you're looking for. This is, take this to be distance or energy, whichever you prefer. But this is distance, 1 over r squared. So you're looking for this drop, huh?
For a fixed energy?
Yes, for a fixed energy.
But you're going to have events that cover a range.
Yes, yes,
okay.
Yes. So then I have to put all of that in to do a proper calculation. And if you want to know more about this game, I direct you to this paper by Huber, Lindner, Schwetz, and Winter, which is a very nice paper written in. They have the amazing capability to take in a simple statement, these Germans, and write it in such a turgid way that I don't understand it anymore. I actually understand less after I read the paragraph than I did before I read the paragraph.
So why do you recommend?
Because they did the calculations right, and they've got some nice figures in there, which you can understand. But I'm just warning you that the text is incredibly turgid.
Rather from old Europe.
It's the old Europeans, yes, that's what it is.
Appendix has all the verbs.
Okay, so this is a sensitivity. They define reactor 1 and reactor 2. Reactor 1 is a 100-ton detector, and reactor 2 is a 1,000-ton detector, basically. And this is their calculations of just bare sensitivity with statistics and with systematics. And so here is where we are with present limits out around here. So this can make a very big jump in sensitivity on theta 1-3. And they also make a strong point that combining these results with JHF to super K also gives you a lot of power because it breaks the degeneracies. And here is an example of that. Sorry, I keep standing in people's way. This is theta 1-3, sine squared 2 theta 1-3. This is delta M squared, so pick some number like here. Here's JHF to super K. Here's reactor 1, the poor reactor experiment, and here's the combined. And so it really gives you some more horsepower to push on down there in sensitivity for theta 1-3. What's your problem, Danny? A little or a lot.
Just for the reactor experiments coming back, you have given the curve for given distance and energy. But if you would give a curve in terms of observed recalled energy, for example.
I think I have one.
Do you still see something?
Yes. So you should see the. It depends on. If you look at the plots people are making, of course you can make a zillion plots for every possible distance. I think I have one here coming up. But this just shows where JHF to super K can go, and then neutrino factory can go on down from that. But in breaking this degeneracy, you still have an advantage with these reactor experiments, just in the other advertisement. So the first people to push this are these Krasnoyarsk folks, who I don't actually know, but there is a big reactor buried in a mountain used to produce plutonium, and so you can make your detectors farther and farther out from the middle of the mountain where there's good shielding. And these guys caught on to this idea, I think. Mikhailian, or is it fair to give them credit for being the ones that were, yeah. And so they're trying to, as we speak, that thing that I passed around, they're attending this meeting in Alabama and trying to drum up collaborators to come and work with them on this experiment in Russia. It'll be a tough sell because it's hard to get there. How long do you suppose it takes you to get there?
Moscow is about maybe 5 hours of flying.
I see. So you have to fly and drive and get to Moscow, and getting things shipped there. It's not going to be very attractive for Americans to go and collaborate there, especially knowing some of the problems that people had working down in Baksan. And so I don't know whether these guys are going to get help or not, but I would hope they would. I'm running way over time here, so let's see. This is the kind of plot that you make, that you would make as a function of energy for the ratio of the spectra at the two different distances. And depending on where you choose the parameters and the distances, the parameters for the true oscillations, you may see some oscillations here, or you may see just one dip. Clearly, you'd like to adjust it so that you'd see at least one dip so that you know what you're doing. So if delta m squared is 2.5 times 10 to the minus 3, and they're at 100 meters and 1,000 meters, and the fire detector gets 16,000 events per year, then with a delta with a sine squared 2 theta of, say, as little as 0.02, you would see a ratio like this, which would be pretty convincing. Naturally, our Japanese friends, not to be outdone, have jumped upon this, as they pretty much own the neutrino industry these days. And Suikani and company have a plan to go to this Kashiwazaki reactor site and maybe dig a vertical shaft and put a detector down somewhere around here and play the game that way. Our friends at Berkeley. You certainly can.
So if you dig the shaft, there isn't a danger of that water coming in?
Well, yes.
Are you volunteering?
So this is a much smaller detector, though.
Oh, yes, and that's the virtue. And that's part of this equation, is that you can make such a thing relatively rapidly. We know how to do it. And deploy it and get a quick measurement. I'll show you a possible timeline in a moment.
Well, what's the size? You usually have a little man standing next to the
Well, for the kind of, if you're talking about a 10-ton reactor, we're talking about something a couple of meters across, right? So here are oscillations at 6 and 7 kilometers with some particular set of parameters. This, in fact, is our Berkeley friends are looking at the Diablo reactor site right up the coast here a little bit, where there's two 3.1 megawatt reactors. Gigawatt. Megawatt reactors would be pretty small. And so the oscillations look like this, and then the ratio with some statistics put in looks like this. And this is for near and far at 1 and 3 kilometers and 6 and 8 kilometers. And so this is what you were asking for with the statistics put in. So people are busily and looking at sites around the US People have investigated our good old IMB site in the Morton Salt Mine near Cleveland, Ohio. There's a reactor just along the lake, Lake Erie, 10 kilometers away from the site, so that's a potential location. This is the Diablo Canyon site, quite nicely isolated and no other reactors around, and possibility to drill back into these hills here for protection. But I'm a little unclear, but I believe there's no existing tunnel there. And this is a map of where all the reactors are around the country. This is Diablo Canyon. This is the reactors down the coast south of Laguna Beach.
San Onofre,
right. And lots of reactors back east. So people have been exploring all these various possibilities. And I know that there's activity at Argonne National Lab, Maury Goodman and company. There are all friends at Caltech who are working on CAMLAN. There's some people at Columbia that are interested. There are some people at Fermilab that are interested. Berkeley, I think, I have not heard of any decision, but from what I'm hearing, it sounds to me like they're going to want to take a role in this.
Yeah, they sound very interested, actually.
Right. So this is another picture of the Diablo Canyon reactor. Two 3.1 gigawatt reactors close together gives you a good, strong source. The typical reactor in this business is around 1 gigawatt. So these are healthy. No reactor off time could be a little problem. We would like to have reactor on, reactor off. They have to stop once in a while to refuel every year or so. So this is the attraction of this sort of an experiment, is that you get started on it essentially right away, and you could have data toward before 2010. And JHF to Super K and whatever NUMMI off axis may or may not come along won't be running until up in this period. JHF accelerator is not supposed to be ready until 2009, and it's not likely to move forward in schedule. So there's every good chance to make a measurement of Theta-1-3 before these other experiments come on the line. So that's what this is all about. And it seems to me to be a good idea. And in a, building the detector and then taking data. I mean, you have to go through the whole cycle of proposal, get money, build the experiment.
What happens between 2010 and 2015?
Well, these other experiments come online and get tuned up, take data, analyze their data.
But the Theta-1-3 reactor
continue to operate, but meanwhile they found out that Theta-1-3 is perhaps not zero, or maybe depressingly small. So there is certainly the opportunity for discovery, and certainly would have long-term impact as long as sine squared Theta-1-3 is greater than around 0.01 at any rate. 0.01 at any rate. Now, if it's within an order of magnitude of present limits, then one should be able to make a discovery with that. And this was the conclusions from these Berkeley guys, and as you can see, it sounds as though they're quite interested to get involved, but I have no idea about what their management may say about this or not. And this was just this workshop that's going on, just to show you that that's happening. So that's the end. That's I think we're gonna see one of these Theta-1-3 experiments, one or more, around the world built. The reactor ones. There's also proposals in Europe. Our friends at CHOOSE reviving their plans. There's also Heilbronn in Germany, another proposal cooking for there, although that one doesn't look to me to be quite as good. But 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, I count at least 6 or so groups that are getting into this business. I should hope that at least one or more of them will succeed. So there may be a Theta 1-3 in your nearer future than you had thought. That's all I have to say.
Thank you.